And hello again, fellow basement dwellers. I am back, Patrick O'Dowd here, after a week off out in beautiful, sunny Las Vegas, sort of sunny Las Vegas. I feel like I was lied to. Not, you know, full disclosure, the weather was not exactly what I was promised. But I'm back. I'm here for another edition of Bandwagon Nerds. With me, as always, is our co-host, Dave Ungar. I heard you get all indignant last week.
I wasn't that
over the name pronunciation.
Not that indignant, just kind of giving you some shit while you were off in Vegas. So. And I've lost money because I had said that I wasn't sure whether we'd ever see you again after a few days in Sin City. You actually had an extra day in Sin City.
Yeah, and it was really funny that you mentioned that because so many people. So full disclosure, I didn't pay for the stay. I won this hotel stay at a bar trivia, right? So I had this 4-day, 3-night stay. Greg comes up and meets with me. And so when I found out that I was going to be stuck in Vegas for an extra day because of weather, Winter Storm Mabel was what it was called. It basically grounded Chicago, which is where my connecting flight was. And Southwest, in its infinite wisdom, couldn't rebook me anywhere else that day. So they were just like, we're going to rebook you to the next day. Where they then rebooked me to fly into Baltimore because I guess. And so people kept on Facebook, like after I was like, oh yeah, I'm stuck another day. People started doing this like nudge, nudge, wink, wink. Like, I bet you're really sad. The other said, yes, I was. And here's why. Cause I had to pay for the goddamn room. Like I had to stay an extra day. I actually had to fork some more money over to stick around. It's not like they just extended. It's not like the company that booked the room for me was like, oh, you know, totally cool. Just have an extra. No, it doesn't work like that. I had to pay the fine people at the Westgate Hotel and Casino. Very, very nice experience, by the way. It was a cool hotel. Just, you know, off the strip, claimed the largest sports book in the world. It was funny with Greg and I there. We talked about it. It was this odd combination of looking both huge and not as huge as we thought it was going to look based on the pictures. But it was pretty amazing. Like movie screen sized sporting events, just all around this giant room. It was ridiculous. But yeah. So yeah, I did spend an extra day in Vegas. I didn't really do anything in that extra day in Vegas. Greg had to go back to Phoenix. So I think the only thing that I had was I had an encounter with somebody's bodyguard, but I didn't realize the person was legitimately a bodyguard. And it was fascinating to me because I was hopping on an elevator and these three people walk in and this couple goes to the back of the elevator. Everybody starts hitting their floor, right? And the third guy with this group hits a floor and I turn back and I look at the couple. And I'm just like, oh, what floor do you need? And they're like, oh, we're with him. He's my bodyguard. And I was like, ah, yeah, right, whatever, whatever. And they were like, yeah, yeah, no. And I was like, you know, you could be a threat. And I'm like, oh, yeah, me and my big Darth Vader shirt, totally a threat. Like, because I was wearing this Darth Vader shirt that a friend of mine gave me. Everybody kind of has a laugh about it. Everybody's sort of standing there. And I just figure it's three people together. And then the door opens. And the guy who hit the elevator button does like the arm out, looking around, watching for people, walking in front of me. The door shuts, and I look at this guy who was in the elevator. I was like, shit, I guess that was real. and so here I was, yeah, goofing off with the security guy, who really was a security guy, but I thought he was not. So
you could have been a mafia hit, man. You never know.
I have no idea. But I do know now that I should take that seriously, because the guy, I think they were a little incredulous. Because I was just goofing off, not really, like, I didn't catch on. So that was the most excitement that happened out of my extra day in Vegas. I did not have a lot of money left to burn at that point. I didn't really gamble much. I'm not much of a gambler, but it was a lot of fun. Got to take in all the sights. Greg and I, you know, did go to a show, see some lady bits. And that was fun.
that made Rick happy.
You know, I know Rick living vicariously through that. We showed up late to that show, which was kind of hilarious because it was Monday of the trip. And we had gone, when we had arrived on Sunday, we actually caught Impact tapings And after catching the Impact tapings, we then went and walked the strip a little bit, but we didn't walk much. Walked through like the Bellagio and walked through Caesars. So the next day, Greg's like, "Well, you got to see the whole strip. So we're going to go see the whole strip." So during the day, we'd gone to the Pinball Hall of Fame, got back, wasted a little bit of time. By the time we decided to head back out there, show starts at 9:30. We exit out of the, the Contemporary or something like that. Cosmopolitan. Cosmopolitan. Yeah. This tells you how impactful this trip was to me. In terms of locations, but Greg wanted to park at the Cosmopolitan parking lot. So that's where we did. So we come out there. He's like, "Okay, we're going to walk this whole strip." And we get all the way down to the, I can't remember the name of the mall that's at the very end of it. Not the Miracle Mall, but the other one. And we're looking at the clock and it's like 9:45 and we've got to get to the Luxor, which is at the other end of the strip by 10:30.
Yeah. Good luck.
We made it. And they're at 10:32.
That's not bad. We
hauled ass and it was crazy. And 10:32 is probably a little earlier, but we got there just as they were finishing the introductory routine. Like, we could hear as we were walking into our seats, the host introducing everybody to the women that were going to be dancing. Greg and I look for our seats. The usher points to it. It is literally the third row up from the stage, smack dab in the middle of a full fucking row. So we had to be the assholes that while these women are standing there, we're walking in front of them to like get our seats in the middle. And the disappointment on the people's faces that were to the left and right of us and our seats when we showed up to take our seats was outstanding. But,
it sounds like you had a good time. Vegas is a very interesting city. I mean, there's no place like that anywhere in the world.
Not at all. You know, and everything's huge there. Like, you know, and I know people say that. The other thing that I learned is that everything basically starts, the cost of everything starts at $20 and goes up from there. You know, bottle of water, $20. The standard size, you know, package of Kit Kats, $2 or $20.
Yeah. Everything. The buffets are surprisingly affordable, but other than that,
right, because it's a buffet. Right. Yeah. I think my favorite sticker shock though was, I went to a Starbucks that was in the hotel where I was staying and got a Grande Pike's Place. And that thing cost $6 and Midwest me turned full Midwest farmer guy and was like, "What the hell are you talking about? That is coffee. Just give me the coffee and a dollar. You get a dollar." Like $6 for standard Pike's Place Starbucks coffee, whatever. But yeah, a lot of fun. A lot of fun. It was great. Hadn't seen Greg in nearly 4 years. And you know, his birthday, by the way, on the day of the recording, today is Greg's birthday. So happy birthday.
Happy birthday to Greg and Rick. It's both their birthdays today.
Oh, and Rick. Happy birthday to Rick as well. As you all can probably guess, Rick is not here today. He's going to be on a little hiatus, couple weeks.
Yeah.
So, just a little bit of time away for Rick. We're not going to bust his chops too hard.
Before we leave the Vegas discussion, let me ask one last thing. Lots of rumors. WrestleMania is coming there. It is coming to LA next year. WrestleMania in Vegas, probably almost certain at that Raiders Stadium. That town, in my opinion, I was at WrestleMania 9 many, many, many years ago. It's a lot different town now. What do you think? You think it'll work there? I mean, I think it's a perfect town for WrestleMania.
I think it's perfect for WrestleMania. 1,000%. They're going to have the arena. It's going to allow. It's going to be an experience, I think, and it's always an experience for WrestleMania. It's always something huge, but a place like Vegas, with, you know, the strip, with all the other promotions that are going to be able to run around and book out of various hotel and casino spaces, it's going to be able to fully create a weekend experience unlike anything we've seen before.
And everything is real concentrated in one general area, kind of like New Orleans. WrestleMania next year is going to be weird because you know, the Rams stadium's down in Inglewood or Irvine or someplace like that. And the Staples Center is LA. And you know, haven't been out to California. They're pretty far apart. And it's not very easy to get to either one. So, yeah, Vegas is going to be fun. But I'm glad you had a good time, man.
I did. When the Mrs. O'Dowd called me at one point, as I did, I was a good husband, called in, talked to the wife and the little O'Dowd every day. But at one point I did say to her, I was like, it was cool, but like, and I could go back, but I don't know that I ever need to go back. If that makes any sense. Like it'd be fun. But I was like, it's cool. I'm okay with it, but
you need to go with us, Patrick. We'll show you some of the good stuff.
Hey, I don't know, the dive bar that I did some karaoke in on my last night there. And I mean, that place was a fucking hole and I loved it. You ask Greg, next time you talk to Greg, ask him about the joy on my face at the karaoke night. And I can't even remember the place. I got a cup that has the name of the place on it. Everything lights up. Ellis Island. That might've been what it's called or something like that. Or no, not Ellis Island. I can't remember what it's called, it was like off the strip, like well off the strip. And it showed there were some hard edged people doing some gambling in that particular hotel and casino.
Single deck blackjack, shit like that.
Right. Very much so. So anyway, but that was my trip. It was a lot of fun. I'm glad to be back. We're here to part 5 of the 80s project today. We're going to cover that. It's horror movies, horror.
Yeah. We left that part in Vegas.
Yeah, we did leave that part in Vegas, and we're going to talk a couple other things. We're going to go back to the trailer park today, sorta, because we're going to talk about kind of a trailer, and then both of them are kind of trailers, like for real. And we're going to talk a little He-Man, as there was some news that broke on Kevin Smith's upcoming He-Man anime series that I'm going to have to make sure that I have the page open to go over and talk about, because there's some good stuff in there. But before we get into all of that, we got to continue talking about The Witcher. And I did stay on pace. I did watch episode 5. I watched episode 6 yesterday, I want to say, during the day, which was perfect. Got to soak it all in. And, you know, here we are. Freight train heading toward a climax. And pieces are starting to fit together. You have the further complication of Yennefer and Geralt's relationship. You have a little prophecy involved and more fate, just more stories of fate as we look at Geralt having to meet his destiny with Ciri eventually, Yennefer being told that she's not going to be able to ever recover her womb and have a child, and Geralt finding out that he can't have the woman he loves, and the fact that he does love and makes him unique and unusual to what we are told to believe about Witchers. So to me, another great episode, plus it had dragons, and how can you go wrong with dragons?
Yeah. I don't know about one of the best episodes, but for me, it's one of my favorites because they really explored the relationship between Geralt and Yennefer. So this is obviously, I don't know how far after their first meeting and sexual encounter, but you can tell, okay, they've been together a few times. One or the other always abandons the other. That sort of situation. It's so interesting because when they're together, there's this, you know, and forgive me for being sappy, but this is just the way it is. There's a certain sweetness about the two of them that is kind of like they're very awkward with each other. They're not comfortable in their own skins. And the fact that they do have these feelings for each other, especially Geralt, who's not supposed to have feelings. Witchers aren't supposed to have feelings. And it's clear he does. And it's clear that, you know, Yennefer's hiding or shielding herself from the fact that she cares for him too, behind this whole guise, well, this is what I'm after, this ultimate quest to regain my ability to have children. And Geralt basically calls her out and is like, why would you want that? You would be a terrible mother. You know, why would either of us want to raise the children with our kind of lifestyles? You know, why would we want to do that?
Right.
But So it's a fascinating dichotomy of a relationship between the two. And yeah, you've got the gold dragon. You've got the stuff going on with Ciri and Dara figuring out that this imposter Mousak is full of shit, barely escaping that situation. You've got the Doppel turning on the guy hiring him. You know, now you've got Geralt and Ciri seemingly on a collision course to each other as to how they get there. Yennefer's gone her own way, presumably, you think, but I doubt that. I'm sure that they're going to be tied in together. But it was a great episode, though.
This is very much one of those penultimate to the climax of a season episodes. That's the way that I really, because
there's eight, right?
Right. 8 or 9. I can't remember. Okay. I think you're right. There's 8 because I remember looking, there's 2 episodes left. And what I really found great, and it's tropey, but it's what a lot of series do. You got to bring people together and then break them apart. And we saw that at the end of this episode. At the end of this episode, nobody is with anybody. Geralt is on his own. He's throwing the Bard out. He and Yennefer have pulled apart from each other because Yennefer believes that their infatuation and that their crossing has to do with a wish he made with the genie, which doesn't seem to be true. You have over with Ciri, her rejecting, I forgot his name, Dara, the elf.
Oh yeah, Dara.
Dara.
Or he actually rejected her.
He rejects her. He's like, I'm done with you. So suddenly now everybody is on their own again. We are back. We started apart. Some of us came together. We've broken apart again. And now it's hurtling towards this finale over the next 2 episodes. And so what really has to be the crux of things is we still don't really know why Ciri is important other than that she's super powerful. Like, really, that's what we know. And so we have 2 episodes left to explain it, and I'm pretty sure it's going to be left in a cliffhanger where that's where the big reveal is going to be. I think that, you know, we're now at that Geralt's got to face his fate. Yennefer's going to be continuing to try and make her fate. And will Geralt get to Ciri in time?
Yeah, I think, yeah, like you're saying, there's a lot of everybody's on their own, a lot of paths seem to come together. Now they're pulling apart. You got to figure that some of those will come back together by the end of 8. I expect, you know, my guess would be Yennefer and Ciri are going to have something to do with each other. That would seem that would logically make sense. But I'm fascinated. Now you've got this prophecy. The thing ends with the time of sword and axe is nigh or something like that. I'm like, okay, well, that sounds foreboding. But yeah, I love this series, man. I'm bummed that we've only got 2 episodes left, and then we got to wait till 2021 for something new. That's gonna suck. But
we're gonna find something else to get excited about. You know that. Like, we'll find a new series. Looking around, who knows? The Boys has got to be hitting again soon. Oh, you don't have Amazon Prime, do you?
I don't. But I hear the one I hear a lot about is Lock and Key. That I've heard a lot about.
Lock and Key. I haven't watched any of it yet. I read Lock and Key years and years ago. That one just dropped on Netflix not too long ago. That's a possibility. Plus the Disney Plus series are going to start hitting soon too. The Falcon and Winter Soldier. I think that one's first. So we got things to do. We'll have other series to cover, and we'll have a great time doing it. But we'll have to see where The Witcher goes. We'll have to see what our thoughts are going to be of this series as a whole when we get our cliffhanger, which is really, let's call it what it is. We got our cliffhanger. We got a cliffhanger coming, Dave.
I can't imagine it's all going to be neatly resolved by the end of episode 8. That's just not going to happen.
No, that's just not how these things work. So we're going to put a bow on The Witcher episode 6, and we're going to look forward to talking about number 7 next week. Maybe with a PC Tunney, maybe with a Greg DeMarco, maybe somebody else. Maybe we can find another. Who knows?
There are people who have wanted to be on this show.
So, there are, I know, and I think we're thinking of the same person.
We had women last week, so that was a breakthrough for us.
I know. I was really disappointed because I wanted us to put like a big sign that was spelled poorly that was like no girls, but it was like, you know, girls spelled G-U-R-L-Z, Or the S is backwards, like a treehouse.
I freely admit the girls carried that show last week, so I was just there for the ride.
Kudos to the misses. Kudos to the niece.
Yeah, right? My niece.
Yeah. So thank you very much for pulling a band together, any band together, man. That was great.
Bailing me out.
So let's move on to another bit of news that hit a couple days ago. There'd long been talks and plans for a revival of He-Man and the series He-Man from the old 80s cartoon that's had various renaissances over time. This one being the latest and being run by none other than Kevin Smith of Clerks, Mallrats, more recently some more bizarre films like Yoga Hosers and Tusk. But definitely known for his View Askew movies, definitely known for Jay and Silent Bob in that universe. But he is bringing up a He-Man anime series, and there was an article releasing the voice cast that started making its waves, making its rounds the other day. And before we get into the cast, I was a big He-Man. I'm sad that Rick's not here because I know this is about a decade after you gave a shit. But am I wrong? Am I wrong?
I was never a huge, I mean, I liked it fine. Sure. It just, there's some characters from the He-Man universe that are just like, what the hell is going on? You know? I mean, but that's,
that was the '80s. Like that was the '80s. That's what you did.
It was a fun show. Cool show. I mean, I never liked He-Man's outfit. I'm like, but you know, and he had a bowl haircut and that stuff going on, but Skeletor was awesome.
Well, what always cracked me up about, that was the thing about 80s cartoons in a lot of ways. A lot of them, the villains were always more interesting than the heroes on some level. You know, Mrs. O'Dowd used to always question my sexuality because I loved He-Man so much, given the outfit, because it's, you know, it's furry underwear.
I had a lot of the He-Man action figures when I was a kid, though. I mean, I had a He-Man, Man-O-War, Skeletor, Battle Cat. I mean, who was it? She-Ra? Was that the girl? Or
She-Ra was his sister, yep.
Yeah, so I had my fair share of He-Man stuff.
Well, and let's be real. She-Ra is having a very successful run on Netflix as its own animated series. Very exciting take on that. But I grew up on He-Man. I grew up on that. Had all kinds of action figures. Had Castle Grayskull. So I was able to, play around with that.
The set, right? They had the set. Right, yeah. I had that too. Right.
Snake Mountain. I had characters like Stratos and Triclops and all these different Man at Arms. My favorite was this character, Man E Faces. He had a little top on the top of his head.
Yes.
You could screw it around and it made a human face, a robot face, and a monster face, depending on what he was doing. Trap Jaw, which was like the first character I ever owned, where you could replace his arm with various weapons. Instead, he was so cool, and his jaw was a working, moving jaw. It was so great. But the cartoon was a Filmation cartoon, ran for a couple of what you would call a couple of seasons, basically about 100 episodes. No real continuity at the time. A lot of those cartoons didn't. It was a character of the week sort of thing, and it was all done to sell toys. Let's be real. There wasn't anything special about this cartoon. It does not age well. I own them on DVD and I watch them every once in a while for nostalgia's sake. And I get about 4 episodes in before I'm like, whoa, yeah, this is pretty bad. But fun fact about that series, some pretty famous names at different times in comics worked on that show. Most notable for me was J. Michael Straczynski. Wrote a lot of episodes for He-Man, and the figures actually came with a comic book when you bought them. Yeah. That little comic book was written. I can't remember the guy's name, but again, I've pimped this show so many times on our show. But The Toys That Made Us has an episode dedicated to He-Man and talks about its development and how that all came to be and the responsibility of the comic artist versus the show and how terrible the movie was and all that stuff. But the reason this whole thing made news is they announced the cast today, and it popped up in my Twitter feed because of one name. And it's a great name to have in any animated movie or any animated series
or anything
and anything. And Dave, what was that name?
That would be the name of one guy. I think his name's Mark Hamill. I mean, I hear
he's done a few projects here and there.
I've heard of him a time or two. Yeah.
A couple of movies.
A couple of low-grade sci-fi films, you know.
Yeah, he's done a little voice acting, too. He's done a little voice acting, you know, and one, like, character that he seemed to do pretty well with and has made a decent name for himself.
Yes, exactly.
Let's stop. He's huge.
He's the voice of the Joker. He's the voice of lots of different things. And
when we put our Twitter poll up over who was the best Joker, and I'll even own it, I was the one who put that poll up. I got lambasted in the comments because I didn't include Mark Hamill's Joker and I didn't include Joaquin Phoenix's Joker, and instead kind of trolled the audience by putting in Jared Leto's Joker, which got, I think, no votes, maybe one vote.
voted by accident, maybe.
Right. Maybe missed the button that they were trying to pick. But in the 90s, when that Batman the Animated Series was running and the multiple iterations afterwards, for the longest time, there was one guy that was the voice of the Joker. And that was Mark Hamill. And so them announcing Mark Hamill, and what's the role he's playing, Dave?
He will be playing Skeletor.
Playing the bad guy. Playing Skeletor. This is exciting casting. I'll be very, very interested to hear how this goes and how he does. I think he'll do a great job. He's been a very reliable voice actor for years and years and years now. Right. And it looks like something he truly enjoys. And he enjoys working with Kevin Smith. He has worked with Kevin Smith before in various iterations as well. So that always bodes well for a good collaboration.
But it will. I mean, he'll knock it out of the park as Skeletor, but he's not the only name that I know you wanted to talk about. They've released a hell of a cast for this thing.
This is a ridiculous cast, and it's really a where to start. So Mark Hamill is Skeletor. Yeah, that's a good headliner. But, you know, just looking at this, I'm just going to start. Lena Headey. Of Game of Thrones and 300 is voicing Evil Lyn. Sarah Michelle Gellar, Buffy the Vampire Slayer, Cruel Intentions. She's voicing Teela. Steven Root. I love Steven Root. Is voicing Cringer. Not Battle Cat. No, just Cringer. I'm not seeing a Battle Cat voice. The original Skeletor, the original voice of Skeletor, Alan Oppenheimer, is Mossman, which I think is kind of cool. Henry Rollins, yep. Is doing Triclops. Like, you're going through this, and it's just like every name.
They isn't Kevin Smith's daughter, Harley Quinn Smith, is doing a role, right?
Right, Alicia Silverstone.
Oh, geez.
Justin Long, is doing. From Galaxy Quest and Live Free or Die Hard and a myriad of other things. He's doing a voice. Jason Mewes, Jay himself.
Yep.
Phil LaMarr from Mad TV. Tony Todd, Candyman. Just, you keep going through this. Harley Quinn Smith is a minor character, it looks like. Alina, I'm not quite sure. It's nuts to look at this. And I think this speaks to the strength of Kevin Smith and people who want to work for him.
It does. And I think it also speaks to the strength and the longevity and kind of the, there is a passionate fan base about He-Man and the Masters of the Universe. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's not kid ourselves. There is a lot of people.
Oh,
out there.
I'm one of them. I'm very excited. About
I know.
This.
And I mean, I'm a fan of it too, probably not to your level, but I mean, I can see the allure of it and the fact that they are going to relaunch this thing with a cast like that tells me, okay, they're taking this really, really seriously and trying to put forward the best, most entertaining product possible and introduce this whole universe. I mean, it is kind of its own universe to a new generation of fans. And I think that's fantastic.
And the basic story that they have is a synopsis. It's called Masters of the Universe Revelation. It's going to focus on unresolved storylines from the iconic characters, picking up where they left off back in the 80s. So That's interesting. I'm looking forward to seeing how that pans out and how that plays. So
I wonder if they're going to have the same theme song. That theme song in the 80s was banging.
It's totally dope. Here's my question for you. Can you think of a bigger voice acting cast for an animated series?
No, not real. I mean, maybe some of the DC animated movies have had really good cast, but I don't know about on that level from top to bottom with that many players. No,
right?
No, I can't.
It's insane, and so I mean, it's got a lot to live up to, but damn, that's a hell of a cast, and that is a great way to get this thing started. So
yeah, it's exciting. That's for sure.
Right. And, and I think that's where I'm going to leave that for now. I'm looking forward to more news. I think we're going to see a little bit more. I can't wait for the first images, first artist renderings of the look and what that's going to, because that's the next big step is how is this going to look? Is this going to look and feel? Cause there was a re-release in like, I want to say like 2007, 2008. It was really good. I'm actually sad that series didn't make it.
They haven't announced though, who's playing He-Man yet. Are they? Have they?
Yeah, they have.
Oh, who's that?
It's in that article, and I closed it because I was getting ready to move on. So now I got to re-get it.
It's Dolph Lundgren, isn't it? It's going to be Dolph
Lundgren. It is not. It is not Dolph Lundgren. Silly man. it's shame on you. All right. It is funny, though, as you look at this list, he's the third name that's listed. It's Chris Wood, who's been in Supergirl, The Vampire Diaries.
Yeah.
Supergirl, I'm sure you watched that, DC freak. So you should be able to track him down and figure out who he is right away.
I will have to work on that.
Right. You get to it. Right. So yeah, I think the artist renderings and the initial looks, cause that's going to really make, I think, a huge difference. It definitely seems like with this kind of cast and who's directing it, that it's going to be kind of along that, like, we're going to take this seriously, like not goofy fantasy sort of thing. And I say this as a guy who saw the newest Thundercats cartoon previews and was like, this is not what I want to watch because it's kind of silly.
It'll be cool. I mean, I'm looking forward to seeing what they do. With, like you're saying, right. The artist renderings will be good. And just it's like, okay, give us a debut date. Let's go.
Yep. And let's hopefully it's on Netflix because then I can make you watch it.
I will gladly watch it, Patrick.
I know you'll gladly watch it. Well, and I know a couple of other things that I made you watch this week.
You didn't make me watch any of this.
I'm sure you saw it, but I put it on. When I put it on the rundown, the expectation is that you've either already seen it or will go look for it.
Yes.
So I'm going to assume. But there were two trailers that I wanted to talk about. And like I mentioned at the top of the show, they're not really trailers per se. But the first one that came out kind of set a certain fan base on fire as Netflix dropped a 1 minute video that they called the Stranger Things teaser trailer that freaked everybody out. And Dave, I don't know. First of all, Stranger Things, what are your feelings about Stranger Things as a show? Did you watch the show? Have you followed it? What do you think?
I am not caught up. I'll admit that I have watched it. Dude, it's just a time thing, you know. This day job sort of thing really fucking gets in the way. But I have seen parts of it. I love the show, what I've seen of it so far. I will freely admit that I went to my wife because she's caught up with it. I mean, I could get her in here. She could talk to you about it, but she's got bronchitis. So I just said, I'm not sure what this trailer is all about, but I know people are really freaked out about it. But it's like, how are they all in a Russian slave labor camp now? And who is it? Hawkins? Is that that's the sheriff?
Hopper. His name is Hopper.
Hopper.
Hopper, get the fuck out of here. You know what? I get that you got to pick and choose how you binge watch because you're practically knocking on death's door as it is, you old fart.
Yeah. And that's but, my wife said the exact thing. You need to binge watch this, babe. And I'm like,
yeah, binge watch this. Here's the thing is the particularly season one is such a bingeable show. And I kicked that thing on with my wife and we blasted through season one. We flew through season two. Season three upped the stakes. And again, we tore right through it. It came out so hot with its first season. I would argue that season two and three, while quite good, have not matched. And it's hard to match kind of the mystery that was involved with season one. Like season one had this great hook and you know, cashed in on nostalgia, but not in a way that felt like it was pandering. It was a lot of fun. It was great. And it's been challenging as the kids have gotten older and they've had to up the stakes of the show, which is how we end up in Russia. And yeah, the big reveal is that you've known in season three, you know, that Russia's involved with something, that they're doing some experimenting with this universe. And Hopper is presumed dead at the end of that episode, at the end of that series, at the end of the season three. Because he disappears, you see no more. But they have an after credits tag in Russia where they're talking about a prisoner, and people were hoping it was Hopper. And so to open up the trailer with this minute long trailer with people hammering away on train tracks in Russia, people wondering, what is this? What are they doing? And people instantly who have watched the show knew exactly where they were taking us. And we're like, please let Hopper be there. Please let Hopper be there. And then when he turns around and takes the hat off, people are like, oh, it just reminds me how great a series can be, that it can have a trailer that literally tells you Jack and shit and Jack left town. And yet here we are being like, this is going to be so great. All because there's a character that they love that we're presuming is alive. Now, this is Stranger Things. There's probably something wrong with the guy, because that's usually how this stuff goes. But we don't know. We don't know. We just know that it appears that Hopper will be back. We it appears that he is in Russia, and it'll be interesting to see how or if he gets back to the group, because it's all, again, we're splitting people up and then bringing them back together.
Aye, comrade. I must break you.
So your new homework is, one, to never say I must break you on the show again, and then two, get caught up on Stranger Things by the time season four starts to hit, because I guarantee you that's going to be a watch along. That's gonna be a thing.
I tell you what, when Rick starts doing his homework, then you can chastise me about doing my.
No. I'll tell you what.
But the problem is, I want to do that.
How about we do a barter system then? How about this? Because I still owe you Crisis on Infinite Earths or whatever. Yeah,
I haven't finished that, but everybody who's seen it is really like, even people who aren't DC fans, kind of like you. Like my buddy, he said, dude, you know, I'm not the biggest DC fan, but I got to admit that was badass at the end of that whole thing.
Right. So I'll tell you what, we'll make it a trade. I'll catch up on some DC Universe television. You catch up on some Stranger Things. We'll convene by the time season four hits, we'll be all for it.
Deal. When does it launch?
Oh God. It's like waiting on Game of Thrones, man. Like I can't even remember. You got time.
Okay.
Let's just say you got time. I think the last one last year's released on the 4th of July, around that time. So, and the series actually picked up literally around the holiday. So it kind of made sense.
Okay. I will definitely work on that.
But as you helped me with transitions, you mentioned something. I discovered a new game that I'm going to love playing from here on out. And it's just that it's called How to Piss Off Dave Ungar. And it's called Run Down DC Comics and Call Them Trash and then Just Watch Dave Freak Out. You got all like, I made a joke. Hey, you got all like,
I didn't know. I thought you were serious.
You nerd posted respectfully disagree, which is all, that's nerd speak for get the fuck out of here. I hate you.
Get off my lawn.
Fuck off. That's all it is a lot of F-bombs going there. It was really funny. And so, yes, boys and girls, if you'd like to set Dave Ungar off, just talk about how Superman is trash and nobody likes him. And you're gonna get a reaction. You're gonna get a response.
A lot of people do that, man.
Man, I gotta tell you, I don't hate DC. I don't go out of my way to find DC material. Like I will own that.
I'll tell you but what. Like, after yesterday at Magic Mountain, which is a DC theme park, man, right. They shit the bed yesterday. It's just a disaster of a day. No. But I mean, we won't talk about it. I mean, it's just too much bullshit.
We got to cut through all the bullshit, but there was another little teaser that came out this week that, and again, it's too bad Rick's not here, because we got our first look at Batman.
He was tagging me with that thing the second it dropped, and I was like, sure. You got a better picture. I can't really see what's going on here. And
Pattinson Man.
Yeah.
Our Patman. That's our Patman. That's what we're going to call. Looked, I mean, it's kind of tough with the lighting, and it's, you know, just a snippet of a dude in a costume, but looks pretty good.
It does.
The costume looks pretty good.
There's a famous, I think I tagged you with it earlier today, a famous artist on Instagram or on the internet has actually added the Batman colors to that costume.
Right.
And that looks really, really badass. That looks really awesome. Yeah. If that's what it's going to look like. Yeah, I mean, it's like, did you guys, like, have you watched The Fiend too much? Why are you doing all this red lighting on this reveal? I kept waiting for The Fiend to come out and Mandible Claw Robert Pattman, which would have actually been cool. But, you know, I think, like, the biggest thing about the reveal was just, okay, the theories as to the suit, which have been quite a few of them. I mean, the one.
Well, and you told me there's some doozies out there, I'm assuming, in the land of Reddit and whatnot.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, we were talking about it yesterday. We were ironically at Magic Mountain, sitting in line for an hour for one ride. And we were talking about some of the theories that have come up. I mean, the most prevalent is that it's the suit from the Arkham Asylum video games, which seems to be the one that I would accept because it does look like that. The weird one I heard that it seems to be gaining traction, though, is that the bat insignia on his chest is actually the gun that was used to murder his parents that has been melted down by Batman and turned into that chest plate. And I'm like, wait a second. How would he have acquired that gun when he was just a kid when all this stuff happened? I can't imagine they held on to that. I mean, I suppose it's possible.
He looted Joe Chill's body.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, he dug it up or something. You know, but that's the weirdest one I've heard. You know.
I'm gonna return that theory. Yeah, like, and I want a receipt. I'm gonna return that one. I don't buy that one. Come on.
But that's the one that seems to be getting some traction. I mean, it would be
That's the sort of stupid. It's like a wrestling rumor. It's the sort of shit people want to get excited for, and then are going to be pissy about when it's not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I
see, and this is why DC is trash, ladies and gentlemen. Jesus. Pretty full circle like that. You see that?
Yeah, this is why DC's trash, because they have these stupid theories of shit going on, and
just nothing like that happens with Marvel. Nobody's speculating anything about Marvel. I'm just
There's no speculation at all about it. I mean, it's like they were saying something today that Black Panther's going to appear in you know, Multiverse of Madness, and now you're just keeping a running count as to how many characters are supposed to make a cameo in that movie. It's like
it's
the entirety of everybody that's supposed to show up in Phase 5 is going to appear in this one movie.
Well, so, you know, I haven't told you my theory about this movie yet, have you? Have I?
Batman or Doctor Strange?
No, about Multiverse of Madness. No. I don't think I've mentioned this.
No.
I'm going to get away from this a second. What if Scarlet Witch is the bad guy?
She could be.
What if WandaVision is her psyche breaking off into these different scenarios of being married with the Vision that is causing problems within a multiverse? Which is not an unheard of thing, because in the comics, when she does No More Mutants, it's because she's gone insane, created her own reality where through Magneto, where Magneto has taken over, and it's the House of M sort of storyline. There's another one in the Avengers 500th issues.
Yeah, they bleed. No more mutants in House of M. You know, they're kind of conjoined with each other. So.
Right. And the other one, and then there's another scenario where her children aren't real. Her children with the Vision aren't real, that they're constructs that she made up in her own mind that she made into existence.
Yeah.
So, and that drives her nuts when she finds out that they're not real.
There are many places where Scarlet Witch's reality is, you're not sure, okay, is this really reality or is this just her augmented reality?
Like, so there's, and I don't know that that's real. Like, this is my playlist, as Greg would call it, for what I think would make a really intriguing Doctor Strange having to step in and fix what Wanda has warped. We'll see. I've been wrong many, many, many times in the past. But yeah, the Batman costume thing, it looks good. It is easy to hide a lot of things with red lighting and dark shadow. And again, tells you absolutely nothing about the movie. Tells you absolutely nothing about what it's going to be like. But it gives you a look. And that's what I think, you know, people are starved for. That kind of thing, starred for that kind of look, and just want to be, and let the speculation begin. And that's really what is kind of fun about these projects when they're getting started or put into motion is what could be versus what eventually becomes what is.
Yeah, I mean, it's like you said, we don't know anything about the movie. This is just the very beginnings of it. Does it, you know, I don't know if it makes the fan base more optimistic or less optimistic. I'm not sure. It's awfully early in the game to think about that, but it's something, you know, and that's the most important thing. It's like, look at it. It's like, well, he kind of looks like Batman. Sure.
He kind of looks like Batman. You know, nobody thought Michael Keaton could pull it off, and here we are.
That's true.
So, all right. Well, we're going to take a little break now and jump into part 5 of the 80s project, talk some scary movies when we come back. But we got to pay the bills. We forgot to mention, again, that we are here on the Chairshot Radio Network, which is part of eWrestlingNews.com. So head on over there. Head on over to Chairshot.com to give us a listen, give all of our other podcasts a listen. But we promised Greg that we would play commercials. And so this is the part of the show, your intermission, if you will, where we play a few commercials, pay some bills. We'll be right back.
TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
Why should you visit TheChairShot.com? TheChairShot.com is your home for hard-hitting reviews, news, opinion, and analysis. With attitude. Why? Because you're smarter than the average fan. TheChairShot.com. Always use your head.
This is your boy Kenny Killer telling you to make sure you check out TheChairShot.com. Bringing you breaking news, interviews, podcasts galore, everything pro wrestling. Make sure you check it out, TheChairShot.com.
Okay, and we're back.
Before we get to the 80s thing, I did want to ask you one thing, kind of a surprise this weekend. Sonic the Hedgehog, 60 million plus opening weekend.
I'm not even a little surprised by that dollar amount.
Double what Birds of Prey has done. You know, there is some theory to what Patrick's saying about DC. When you look at those numbers, it's like, wow, I didn't expect. And Sonic getting really good fan reviews.
Right. Which is interesting when you consider its start. Like that first trailer when that hedgehog came out and people lost their shit.
Yeah, exactly.
Rightfully so, because it was terrible. But it was impressive to see a studio listen to the fans, and it clearly is paying off. In fact, it's funny you mentioned Sonic. The little O'Dowd and I are probably going to go see it tomorrow for President's Day. So we don't have school, and so we're going to take him out of the house for a little bit. I'm not surprised at all. I don't know why. I am honestly surprised that Birds of Prey did as poorly as it did. And I think it's more than a title. I think it is a bias towards DC. Like, it's got a lot working against it because of its company and because of its brand. And because that movie looks good.
It's like
I
good.
Haven't seen it.
It's very good.
I haven't
good.
Seen it yet, but it looks good. It looks fun.
You'll like it. When you see it, you'll like it.
But I don't know what's not connecting, what Warner Brothers hasn't figured out that is causing it to fail to connect with fans. And to me, changing the title wasn't what wasn't connecting with the fans. You know what I mean? Like that's give me a break. So we'll see what happens. It sucks that movie is heading towards the land of being a bomb. I think it's gonna be number 2 this week.
Probably. I don't know. I mean, I'm hoping it. I mean, there's a lot of stuff going on Twitter with people trying to raise awareness of it that I've noticed in the past couple of days. But whether that makes a difference or not, I don't know.
Yeah, it's rough. And you know, like I said, it's making, I mean, at least it's not Cats. You know, it could have been Cats.
That's true. That's true. But, could have been Justice League, you know. Oh, well, actually, Justice League's doing better than.
I was like, it's worse than Justice League. I mean, you want it to be Justice League. But enough about that. We got part 5 of the 80s project to get through. Just the two of us today, which I'm a little disappointing because this is another genre. It was funny as I was working on this list. We're looking at top 10 80s horror movies. Looking at this list and working on it, I came to a revelation putting this list together because I struggled with this list a little bit
harder than I thought it was going to be.
It was harder for me because I couldn't think of ones that were made in the 80s. And it made me realize that I really like 70s horror movies better than I like 80s horror movies.
The Exorcist. Anybody?
Right. Jaws.
Halloween.
Halloween is my all-time favorite horror movie. True story. And the reason it's my all-time favorite horror movie, as we tangent the crap out of this episode today, is because the sense of dread that is built through the stalking of Michael Myers stalking Jamie Lee Curtis throughout that Laurie Strode is outstanding. Everywhere she is, he's in the background. He's just there and nothing's happening. He's right. just there. He's just standing there. And you're just like, when is the next shoe going to drop, man? Such a great movie.
It is. Best horror movies of the 70s, later one of our future subjects, maybe.
Right, right. Carrie. There's just so many.
Amityville Horror. Yeah, let's stop. Let's just stop.
Yeah, yeah. That's all. Someday we're going to do a 70s project. It'll be fine. With just the two of us, I figure it's going to be relatively relatively easy. I haven't gone first in a while, so I didn't even mess with the rotation, but I'm going to go first. You can go second. Well, of course, we're going to do our honorable mentions like we always have. And as usual, I don't know if you looked at my list when I sent the rundown over.
I looked at your list once just because I wanted to try, if I could, to avoid us having the same number one. Because I was like, well, that would be anticlimactic as hell. And I did avoid that, barely.
Good
deal.
But, barely, yeah,
I did. I did see your list.
Cool. So we'll cut through. We'll do we'll do the honorable mentions first. We'll run through those really quickly. And then same rules as always. We'll just take turns going, starting at number 10 all the way up to number one. If we have one that's higher on the list, we skip until we get there. And with only two of us, this should go relatively quick. What say you?
It should. I got your list pulled up just so that I, I'll know right off the bat if, we've got one honorable mention in common. That's kind of cool.
Excellent. So I'll jump in with my honorable mentions first. Actually,
and two of your honorable mentions are later in my actual list.
Got you.
Just so you know.
So we'll let you, since I'm going first on the list, you can rattle off your honorable mentions first.
Okay.
How's that?
Perfect, man. The one that we've got on that we share on our honorable mention list is Fright Night, which is equal parts horror and funny. Roddy McDowell was so good in that. I mean, and it's the 80s were ripe with vampire movies in the late 70s,
sure.
Early 80s. This was one of the best ones. I've got Hellraiser as an honorable mention for me.
Right.
The introduction of Pinhead. I got two deep cuts in my honorable mentions that I'm not even sure anybody's heard of these. One of them is called The Gates of Hell. That was renamed City of the Living Dead. It starts off with a priest hanging himself, and that leads, the regurgitation scene is one that you will not soon forget if you've seen this movie.
Right.
And then the last one is, when I was a kid, we had I think I told you we had Betamax. We had this one tape that was like the holy grail of horror movies. Two of the movies are from the 70s, you're talking 70s. One of them's When a Stranger Calls, which has one of the greatest, twists in it. The other one was this movie called Silent Scream. And then the last one was this movie called He Knows You're Alone, where Tom Hanks was in a horror movie. I don't know if people know stuff.
Nice.
And it was the scariest of the three that were on there. And it's serial killer stalker sort of thing. But those are my honorable mentions.
As well, like you said, I had Fright Night as well. I did have another 80s vampire flick, The Lost Boys. Oh, my goodness. Such a good movie. Pet Sematary and then Sleepaway Camp. You mentioned twists. That one had a very memorable twist that is mildly traumatizing. For those of you who don't know, check out the original Sleepaway Camp and then you'll know and be part of the anointed.
Sounds good.
So those are the Bandwagon Nerds honorable mentions. We're going to dive right into the list with my number 10. My number 10 is The Hitcher, starring C. Thomas Howell and Rutger Hauer. On your list, Dave, not on your list.
No, Pony Boy, not on my list.
Pony Boy, not on your list.
Isn't C. Thomas Howell, wasn't he Pony Boy in The Outsiders?
I think so.
Okay.
This is another one of those movies where the tension that is built over the course of the movie is outstanding as Rutger Hauer follows and tortures C. Thomas Howell and his girlfriend in its entirety and literally drives C. Thomas Howell to insanity and has one of the most memorable, eating scenes that you can ever imagine in a diner As C. Thomas Howell just disgustingly eats a cheeseburger or something like that. I can't even remember entirely what it was. There's people pulled apart by cars. It's such a mind fuck. It's such a mind fuck of a movie. And it was so well done. And Rucker Hauer is amazing. Rucker Hauer is an underrated actor.
Hell yeah.
And he's just terrific in that film.
Yeah, that was a really good one. I one of those ones that you had to sacrifice, or I had to sacrifice for whatever was on the list. My number 10 was on your honorable mention list, and it's Pet Sematary. Based after there's Stephen King has a massive influence on the 80s in the horror movies. I mean, there's like you could probably have like seven or I think I've got a couple of his, at least a couple of his on the list. But Pet Sematary was one of his better books. And the movie was just, you know, they did a really good job of capturing aspects of the book. But I think them bringing Zelda, the crippled sister with meningitis in the back room, the embarrassment of the family in the back room. Oh, man, that chick has given me nightmares more than a few times. And it's just. It's such a tragic story, and it just, you know, especially it gets even worse at the end where he just won't let it go because he can't. And of course, bad ramifications. But absolutely love Pet Sematary book and movie.
Right. You know, Fred Wynn. Fred Wynn's the best part. Yeah. Is one of the great part of that.
Yeah. Sometimes, I mean, one of the best lines, sometimes dead is better.
Dead is better. Right. So anyway, so that's your number 10. What's your number 9, my brother?
My number 9 is the other Stephen King aspect of this thing. And it's a collection of some of his better short stories. And it's Creepshow.
Oh, yeah. Creepshow.
I love this thing. I mean, there's he's even in the second story where he turns into a giant plant and ends up killing himself because there is no way out. You know, you've got the story with Ted Danson. And I think I forget the other girl.
And Leslie Nielsen's in that.
Yeah, Leslie Nielsen. Ted Danson's having an affair with, who is it, Adrian Barbeau? Was that who it was?
Yeah.
And, you know, he captures them both, buries them alive, you know, or buries them head high, and the surf comes in, and they've got to watch each other drown on, like, some closed circuit link, and then they both come back. I mean, there's the stuff with the roaches. The second Creepshow, nowhere near as good, although probably... arguably had better stories that it was based around, but it just didn't capture the magic of the first one. I love the first Creepshow.
I don't know. The Raft is a great story.
It is.
Out of the Monkey Shines. Yes. Night Shift or Skeleton Crew. That's the book.
Right.
Skeleton Crew is the short story that came out. That is one of my personal favorite short stories, The Raft. So, yep, but yeah, Creepshow 1 and 2 classics, lots of fun. I went Cronenberg for my number 9. And what's that?
Yeah, I was looking at your list. You did.
Videodrome. So before The Fly, there was Videodrome. James Woods, a sleazy television guy who is airing lowest common denominator stuff. The body horror in this movie. And that when I think of things that I really, really get me in horror movies, great special practical effects with body horror are some of my favorites. And when his body turns into like the television thing that like eats cassettes, it's horrifying yet beautiful at the same time. And the images in that from that movie stick with you forever. And again, it's one of those like at the end of the movie, you're like, what just happened here? I don't know where I am. I don't know what is real anymore. And should I watch television? Because it's not good.
Yeah. What's going to go wrong if I keep watching this?
Right.
It'll rot your brain out, literally.
Right. So I just moved on like as if I just assumed you didn't have video drawn on your list.
I didn't.
That was my deep cut.
But your number 8, however, we'll have to defer that.
Higher on the list, is it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. All right. So what's your number 8?
My number 8 is, I believe this is a John Carpenter movie. I'm not sure. I don't remember, but I think it is. It's The Fog. And
that is definitely a John Carpenter movie.
And it's, I mean,
a hell of a John Carpenter movie.
Yeah. This one is just, the aspect of the fog itself being an entity unto itself and what's actually in the fog. And they wrap this all around a really good kind of story that, you know, this,
yeah, it's a curse.
Yeah, it's a curse. There's this what is it, a colony of lepers or something like that, that they deliberately crash on the rocks and then they're cursed. I mean, and it's just, there's so many creepy things with things knocking at the door and everything in the town going off at a certain time of night. And there's that great music going on in the background and just the sense of dread. Right. And how are they going to get out of this thing? Do they get out of it? And even at the end, where the preacher, who I forget, Hal Holbrook, was that who?
Yeah, played him? Yeah, Hal Holbrook, yep.
And he's like, you know, you took the others, but why didn't you take me? And then he see the fog come in under the stairs, and of course he gets his head cut off at the very end of this
whole
thing.
There you go.
Love this movie, especially here where I live in Bakersfield, because we've got really thick fog in the winters. And every time it gets really, really thick, you walk through and think, it's somewhere in the back of my mind, anybody who's seen the fog, it enters your mind a little bit thinking, I wonder what's out there.
Yeah, either that one or the modernized Stephen King story, The Mist.
Yeah,
You know,
I love that.
Creature in that fog.
I love that movie. A lot of people hate it, but
Stephen King loved that movie, and that's really all I needed to hear. He loved that ending. He wished he had thought of that ending.
Yeah,
so that's all you need
people
to know
are
about
pissed
that.
About. I mean, I understand that ending is one of the worst feelings that you can possibly.
Oh,
have.
Oh God, yeah.
But still,
it's so beautifully tragic. Again, for another podcast. This is what we talked about pre-show, is that we were going to talk too much about
exactly.
other stuff.
Exactly.
So that was your number 8. What's your number 7?
My number 7's higher on your list.
Okay. Well, my number 7
is higher on my list.
Well, son of a bitch. Then I will talk about it later. So that puts you to your number 6.
Your number 6, I think. We're on you now.
Oh, is it me?
Yeah.
So my number 6 is not higher on your list?
It was... lower on my list.
Ah, it's A Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah, it was my number 7.
You know, Wes Craven, classic, arguably, you know, I would say that a lot of Wes Craven's best stuff was, again, in the earlier decade. But, you know, what do I know? But this is the first of a couple of movies that we have on here that launched franchises.
Mega franchises.
And huge franchises, yes. And... the thing about this particular, the first of some of these franchises, they were really scary, like truly scary. And the idea of A Nightmare on Elm Street and dying in your dreams and somebody being able to stalk you in your nightmares and those nightmares become real was quite frightening. And you know, and there's some extreme blood and guts and gore, nothing to what would be, again, would happen in later iterations of A Nightmare on Elm Street. But, you know, Johnny Depp's death scene is iconic in that movie. Which, for the record, young Johnny Depp, that's the bed spewing blood scene. Like, it's just, it's awesome. It's great. It's horrific. And you're sitting there and you're just desperate for these kids to stay awake. You're desperate for the parents to listen. It's that the great thing about horror is these allegories that exist in these morality plays that take place. Like Freddy Krueger was a bad guy, but the families and the parents were bad to him and then had to pay the price for what they did.
Yeah, I think one thing about horror movies in the 80s, where you compare and contrast the modern horror movies, you know, most of the modern horror movies are based, you know, there's a lot of shock value. There's the gore, there's the guts. They're lacking in the stories that made the 80s horror movies. Yes, there was gore and stuff that you hadn't been used to seeing, but they didn't overdo it. And everything was revolved around a great story. And Nightmare on Elm Street is one of those movies revolved around a great story with an iconic evil character that they just created. Freddy Krueger is one of the most iconic characters in all of cinema history, really.
Right.
And it was all just based on, yeah, the concept of a dream dimension being able to have a physical manifestation and how they're dealing with that. And, you know, there's points in that movie where you're not sure, okay, is this a dream? Is this not a dream? You know, even at the very end where all the shit goes wrong at the very end where they think they've won. No, and the
car,
80s, dude,
the car.
Yeah, and the 80s horror movies were masterful at this shit where you think it's okay that they've won. No, they haven't. And there's a couple of movies on here that are like that. I love Nightmare on Elm Street.
So that was my number 6. What was your number 6, Dave?
My number 6, I do believe, is a little bit higher on your list.
Okay. So then we're to number 5. We are flying through this list today, everybody.
We are. Now, I know my number five is also higher on your list, but your number, your number five is not on my list. So let's talk about that.
Really?
Really.
The George A. Romero classic, Day of the Dead, is not on your list.
I had to make tough decisions, Patrick.
That stuns me. This movie, we talk about morality plays, and we talk about, like, the thing I love about horror in general, and this has always been true for horror, is that it's always an interesting reflection on our world. And Day of the Dead is infamous for its, you know, Romero's basically platform to talk about commercialism in America. And this zombie outbreak that takes place outside of the environment where most of the action will take place is we follow a protagonist who shelters into a mall only to then find that the mall is where all the zombies are going to because that's where people flocked. And the statement that's made about commercialism is, it was so clever at a time. And that's the thing is, you know, when I think about horror as a genre and what it can do, like, you can have a platform that teaches or that makes an argument. It's the same reason why I put Videodrome on there, because it's about consumerism and it's about entertainment and what it is that entertains us. And I, you know, even now, like, you look at how we've changed for its time. Day of the Dead was very, very relevant. Mall culture was at its peak in the mid 80s when this movie hit. And, you know, malls are a dying thing now, but it's a terrific film. There's some truly traumatic things. Zombie Baby. It's the first zombie baby I ever saw.
Yeah.
That there was a transformation scene. I love a good transformation scene. We'll talk about this a little bit when we get later into our list. But there's a, you know, one of the soldiers or whoever slowly turning into a zombie and seeing that happen in real time. Great, great stuff. And again, there's no real escape. Like, nobody really wins at the end of Day of the Dead. They just move on to the next spot.
That's right. It was one of those difficult cuts I had to make, sir. Sorry.
Fair enough. So that puts us at number four. As we start to play the jumble list round, I'm assuming this is on yours as well.
It was lower on my list. So yeah, let's talk about it.
All right. So kids, before Jason Voorhees was around, in Friday the 13th, the sequel, there was the original Friday the 13th.
Sequel times 10.
Yes. Where Jason Voorhees wasn't even in the movie for more than 5 minutes. And that's the original Friday the 13th, which is the classic. Again, you know, you would talk about a backstory of a young boy who drowns because the camp counselors were inattentive, partying and screwing. It becomes a morality play. The camp, Crystal Lake Camp, is being reopened. There is a woman who is a caretaker / housekeeper who's there with the new counselors as they are starting to try and reopen this camp. And the counselors slowly but surely start to be killed off one by one. For me, best death in the whole movie, Kevin Bacon,
absolutely,
arrow through the throat.
Absolutely.
Kevin Bacon, arrow through the throat. While he's lying in the bed, post-coital, because you don't have sex in horror movies, kids, or you die. And especially in the 80s, where the virginal woman survives, we'll put air quotes around that. But also, again, one of the best jump scares ever, next to Carrie, in my opinion. The jump scare at the end of Carrie will forever be my favorite. But Jason Voorhees leaping out of the lake to pull our heroine down into the water. Oh, great stuff.
This movie launched, talk about launching another mega franchise, was Friday the 13th. Mm-hmm. And I, like you're saying, a great story. And you're not sure who's doing this. You got Crazy Ralph, who's running around warning people. He's crazy. You got, you know, the one that chased through the woods with the girl getting her throat slashed.
Right.
And stuff that you're seeing in this is stuff that, you know, this is like, what is it, 83 when this came out? Or 80?
Yeah, it was 80. Yeah, it was early.
I mean, it's stuff that you weren't used to seeing. But yeah, at the very end, we used to do this stuff to people. We'd seen it. I mean, Patrick, I must have watched this movie 150 freaking times, man. We had it memorized. Like my stepfather, he was in on the gag with us. He used to, like, people would watch it for the first time where that axe is thrown and it hits the lamp and the lamp shade, you know, swinging. And he's like, oh man, he missed. And then the next thing you know, she falls against the wall with an axe in her head. And you're just like, oh, people are like squirming in their seats. We used to get people at the end of the movie. Good. At the end of the movie, we would be like sitting there, oh man, that was really good. It's great. Everybody survived, knowing that Jason's about to jump over the boat. But people hadn't seen it yet. We would have people like sneak up behind them so that right when Jason jumps around, just horrible stuff. But what an awesome movie. I mean, just creepy, scary, intense.
And you talked about music.
Yes.
That whole thing. That's the other thing that is underrated. We haven't really talked about this in a lot of these movies. And it's, I think, also the godfather of good horror movie music, unfortunately, was made in 1978. That's, again, Halloween. But iconic, good tone setting music just made it so much better. And Friday the 13th had that in spades. When things were going, when you knew things were going south, just so well done.
It's just, I mean, we could have a show, best theme song, horror movie theme songs.
And
we could just go off for forever on that sort of stuff. So that was your number four, right?
Right. So it's your number four.
Yeah. My number four actually, was one of your honorable mentions, but it ranks really high with me, and that's and that's The Lost Boys, which is
Lost Boys.
Such a great it's a vampire movie, but it's so good. And you've got this, you know, the child actors at the time, you know, Corey Haim, rest in peace, Corey Feldman was, or wait, I don't know who, which one of them passed away.
Haim's the one that's dead. Yep.
Okay. And you got Corey Feldman. You've got, you know, Jason Patrick, one of the few roles that he really knocked it in, a very young guy by the name of Kiefer Sutherland, who was the absolute stole the show on this thing.
And the way that he would whisper Michael.
Yeah.
Oh
yeah. And it's and then they do the pretty cool twist at the end where you're thinking they've already debunked the fact that Max could be the head vampire earlier.
Right.
Only to make him the head vampire at the end of this thing through
you don't ever invite a vampire
in your house, you silly boy. So they find this loophole that brings it full circle. And it's just so well done. I mean, I absolutely love this movie. Saw it so many times.
Academy Award winner Diane Weiss, you know.
Yes, yeah, you know, they got the Santa Cruz Boardwalk, which is the backdrop to all this stuff. It's just one of those movies. I mean, I don't know if it's the scariest movie on the list for sure, but probably the best one of if not the best acted, and overall just.
Oh, dude, I'll tell you the campfire scene when they do that, all the kills in front of Michael.
Yes,
that's some great stuff.
That is fantastic.
They just the spray of blood as they're like biting into their heads, like, cause they're not doing that traditional like vampire on the jugular vein sort of thing. And soundtracks. Oh my God.
Oh my God. Yes.
People know the music that the Mrs. O'Dowd had it on CD.
Yeah. Nanook, the big husky wolf hybrid that was just as badass as you could get, you know, squirting vampires with, you know, machine
squirt guns
with garlic water. I mean, it's so good. This everything they did, so good.
We killed the one that looked like Twisted Sister. That's such a great line.
Death by stereo.
Yep. All of that good stuff. It was the child I left behind.
Yeah.
Which is why it was obviously on my honorable mentions. But
a blood sucking Brady Bunch, you know.
That's right. So that was your number four, right?
It was.
So I'm assuming we're going to hit some more overlap because I haven't heard of mine yet.
We are. My number three was lower on your list, but it's An American Werewolf in London, which you talk transformation scenes. This probably has the greatest of all time that still holds up to this day.
See, and this was a real struggle for me because I should have put it in my honorable mentions, but I didn't. And I don't know if it's on your list, but there's two great werewolf movies of the 80s, in my opinion, The Howling being the other one.
Yeah.
Is it on your list?
It was one that I had to cut, but The Howling was the movie that actually I used to train myself how to watch horror movies without hiding my eyes. I just, we made a vow to each other. We're not going to do it this time. We're just going to watch it no matter what. Probably not the best movie to pick to do that because that was scary as hell. But
But and it, to me, it came down to which transformation scene I liked better.
Right.
Between the two. And you're right. The American Werewolf in London transformation scene is long. It's excruciating to kind of watch as they show every bit of David transforming. And unlike the Howling, he's in pain. You can tell that this is not something he wants to do. And that was the big difference. In the Howling, they have embraced the fact that they are werewolves. They have embraced, like, you know, there's factions within that little cult, but like, it's not this torturous thing. And it's not as disturbing almost, in my opinion, because of that. Whereas that whole transformation scene for David, where he, you know, the fingers elongating, the snout growing out, and just the way that that thing is built, the movie being directed by John Landis, who most people would also remember as the director of the Thriller video and a few other Michael Jackson videos.
Didn't
in the
80s. Twilight Zone as well?
He might have. But that, and then you couple that with the ghoul, his best friend, following him around.
Like you're saying,
everywhere.
In the middle of this excruciating transformation where he looks up at the cameras, sorry, I called you a meatloaf, Jack, you know?
Right.
It's so great.
It is. It's and that's the other thing is John Landis. The thing I loved about him as a director is that he was always one of those who embraced full on ridiculous, like, gory horror and injected campy as fuck humor in it all the time. And, you know, them in the porno theater sitting next to each other.
Yeah.
While he's talking to him and being tormented. Good, because he'd been ripped up.
Good flick, you know, all that stuff. And I mean, the movie's so great because it's got another really good story behind it. He and like right. You're saying, you pointed out, he's a very reluctant victim in this whole situation. He didn't ask for any of this stuff.
Such a nice guy.
And David,
like,
Naughton,
you feel for him.
It's not just, I mean, he you know, I was surprised that they didn't have Making It on the soundtrack in this. They should have, you know,
right.
he wrote that song. So. But it's a great soundtrack as well. I mean, and they had the perfect song for that transfer, right, leading into that transformation, Bad Moon Rising, that
right.
leads into that whole thing. But it's oh. it's a, a little O'Dowd scaring you in the middle of this conversation.
Good Lord, I'm sitting there talking about horror movies and I got people creeping up on me.
Yeah. It's just such a fun movie. And
it
know,
was. It was very, very fun.
Yeah. Stay off the moors. Oops. Yeah. That sort
well,
of thing.
I and I sit there at the end of the day, I'm just like, why'd you guys screw up? Why couldn't you just stay?
Yeah. Why did you have to leave?
Why'd you leave that pub?
And everybody's got the, you know, they're all, the whole town's in on the whole secret and they don't
yeah,
want to let
all,
the secret out. And I mean, it's,
yeah, they all know.
And yeah, David's just, he's just a very tragic character. And of course the ending is heartbreaking, but.
It is
necessary.
But, and yeah, and I appreciate that. You know, it made me so mad when they made American Werewolf in Paris and kind of messed with the mythos. Plus the CGI werewolves are just not the same. And I think that that's one of the things that you saw out of the 80s is the just the artistry.
Yeah.
And those makeup effects
they
are,
brought it,
are amazing.
They really brought it to life in a way that arguably even CGI can't replicate.
Right.
There's a level of realism to that werewolf. We're stalking that dude on the subway, and all you get to see is just the werewolf, just for a couple seconds, where he starts crawling towards the dude. Oh,
right.
Man, such
so
a good movie.
Hey,
you know, a shout out to another werewolf movie that didn't make our list, but Silver Bullet was pretty good as well.
Oh, totally, yeah. That's... Yeah, there's too many. Too many out there to put on there. And that was your number four, right? Or is that your number three?
That was my number three. So where are you?
So
you're
my
number three.
My number three showed up on your sci-fi list.
Which is why I left it off.
Well, and that was the thing, is I think I even mentioned on the show that it was going to end up on my horror movie list. And that's the thing. That's my John Carpenter movie. That is... You know, I talked about body horror, and the funny piece of, I don't know if it's funny, but a little bit of irony, as I was flipping through channels last night, movie channel happened to be on, and it is a movie that no matter where I am and or, you know, what time of night it is or where that movie is, I almost always see it through, jump right in. And I came in right at the defibrillator scene, which is such a great moment as the hands go through the chest, opening a maw that then bites the guy's arms off. Oh, so gory.
Yep.
So delightfully, unashamedly gory, with just so, and yet at the same time filled with this tight, tense paranoia amongst this group of men in a completely isolated environment with nowhere to go and no hope for survival. They are dead ducks. And there is, right. and that's how that movie ends. Two men sitting there laughing at the fact that they know they're fucked. Yeah, period.
Exactly. We talked about that on the sci-fi thing. Just the sense of absolute, it's all futile. You guys are done. You've beaten this thing, but it
sort of.
But
and even then, they don't really know if they did beat this thing. But they get to freeze to death.
Right.
And that's how you like. And that's that. And that's. You know, and for my money, you know, talk about tension building scenes. The blood scene is far and away just waiting for the shoe to drop as they are taking the heated wire and putting it on the different petri dishes of blood.
Yes.
And he gets to the one that the blood freaks out and then that transformation takes place. Yeah. Oh, so good. And an easy number three for me.
Yeah, it only reason it's not on my list is because it was on the sci-fi. That's the only reason. So we are at your two, my two and one. And there's a movie that we haven't discussed yet that was my five, which is your number two. I mean, these three movies we're about to discuss for one, two, and three are it's going to be fun.
So my number two is your number five. Is that what you're saying?
Correct.
Wow. Okay, anyway, go ahead.
So it's Poltergeist.
Carol Ann.
They're here. Oh man, jeez, this is a Spielberg movie, and I mean, this movie is so good that the remake that they did just absolutely sucked in comparison in every possible way.
See, now we're back to Dave telling people to get off his lawn. And as I joke about this, I agree with you. I do think that there are some movies to try and remake. That's a tall task. This is one of them, and this really. You know, people, if you want to know why Steven Spielberg is such a great director, look at the variety of types of movies that man put together. And that's what is crazy amazing about Steven Spielberg as a director, is that he could take something like Poltergeist. Again, very simple story. Indian burial ground shouldn't be on here. Causing this house to be haunted and just... Oh, the again, and I go back to the practical effects from the swimming pool with the bodies in it, like you're trying to climb out, to the television with the ghost coming out of the big like puppetry ghost, to the clown doll underneath the bed, which, you know, my kid is terrified of clowns and I can't wait to show him this movie when he's 13 so that I can just watch the trauma. Because it's so good and so intense. And that kid, you feel that kid. You are right there with him. Like, man, I don't want to be you right now, but I want to see what you find.
And see, like the remake put too much. See, the clown was done so well in the original, but they didn't overdo it. And in the remake, they really kind of overstated that whole aspect. And
overproduced it.
You know, put too much of the focus on it. There's little things in that movie. The guy... You know, him teaching him how, hey, this is how a store moves away, which I know when I was a kid, I did the same damn thing. You know, let me count. I learned that from Poltergeist. Let me see if the storm's moving away.
Not the thunder, the lightning.
And then, you know, and then that comes full circle where the tree attacks him. And there's just this ever evolving, you know, the upstairs bedroom. I love the part where they're like, you know, well, we don't go in there since this happened. And they're like, well, there's nothing. Basically, it's like, we've seen it all. And he's like, uh-huh. He opens the door and the whole room is just a paranormal vortex magnified to 3,000 with stuff flying around.
Right.
The compass playing the record. I mean, the little special effects. I mean, the scene where the guy who peels his face away, some more face peeling technology. Eating the chicken with maggots and then it really not having that. So like they're really, the ghosts are really and they seem so playful and friendly at the beginning. And then you realize that they're anything but by the end of this whole thing.
No, it is not. It is not a safe space. And
I thought the second Poltergeist was very good as well.
Right. What's what I've, and unfortunately that series is surrounded by all kinds of horrible tragedies that happened in the making of that film. Yeah. And the subsequent ones. Craig T. Nelson, though, again, just not an actor you would expect to see in a horror flick. playing the dad, trying to hold shit together. I think it wasn't Tom Skerritt in the sequel? Wasn't he like the adopted father or something like that? I want to say that it was him, but not that it matters. But it was it's just so great. And it just shows you how good Spielberg could be. And you knew he had that capability if you saw Raiders. You know, like Raiders has those elements, particularly at the end of that movie. But
the great thing about Poltergeist is it's a definite psychological attack on you. It's not visual. There are visual things, but it's not gore. There's very little gore in that movie, but it is a attack upon your psyche and something that really is deep inside of you that really starts to get at you after a while. And it's such a fantastic movie. And talk about another theme song. There you go.
My top two movies, by the way, are two of the few horror movies that I watched and afterwards was unsettled for a while after I finished watching. There's other movies that have happened later that have left me unsettled. These two, like, I don't go to bed for a good hour after I've watched after I watched the first time. I can watch either of them now, no problem. But the first time, I am disturbed, just very disturbed.
Very fantastic movie.
I think now we're to our number ones, right? Is that where we are now? Do we have another?
We're at my number two, and then
my
number two is your number one.
That's kind of what I thought. So we'll hold off on that. So how many movies do we have left? Do we just have the two?
We're just at our number ones now.
Okay, so let's cover your number one first. I'm assuming I named it.
It was lower on your list, but my number one is, and I did this deliberately I wanted to keep away from your number one, even if there's a part of me that tends to agree with you, but then there's a part of me that says, yeah, this is the number one because it's the scariest one to me on the list, and that's Evil Dead. This movie is just, there's some outlandish shit going on. Obviously, a tree raping a woman. Okay. I haven't seen that before, but that's going to be, when the shit starts hitting the fan in this movie, and I mean, it really hits hard, and there's the banshee, the witch that they've got locked in the basement, taunting people the whole time, every time something goes wrong, and it just keeps getting worse, and it keeps getting worse, and it just keeps getting worse. And then Bruce Campbell is, you know, he's the last line of defense in this whole damn thing. And he seems like he's conquered this, but he really hasn't. And it's just, it's creep. There is no escape. They try and escape. There is no escape. You've got the Book of the Dead made out of flesh. I mean, all the sequels combined did not match the magic that was in this one. To me, I got it number one just because, okay, this is the most, like you're saying, unsettling. This movie unsettled me the most. That just that thing in the basement really got to me in numerous places.
There's something very real about that, like, fear of the basement.
Yeah.
You know, and that fear of, like, what's down and what's lurking. And that is very well done and very well put together.
Right. I think it ranks higher because there was just this feeling that, okay, what's around this corner that is going to really bother me? And of course, the number one movie has that. Your number one has that a lot as well. But this one just kind of got to me a little bit more. I like the visuals. The gore in this was on a higher scale. But it just, you hadn't seen a movie really done quite like this at that time frame.
Well, and I think one of the things I found really fascinating about this movie, you know, and Sam Raimi, who has obviously gone on to do all kinds of other wonderful things, this was the first movie that they made. And the story behind how this movie got made, if you want an interesting book to read, and I strongly recommend you check this out, it's Bruce Campbell. Wrote an autobiography. It's called If Chins Could Kill. And most of that book, he's written a subsequent biography that's been a follow-up because this one ended around the time of his the Hercules and Xena years and those shows that he did around then and movies like McHale's Navy. But the first half of that book is really about him growing up with Sam Raimi and his brother and their desire to become filmmakers and their decision in how they made Evil Dead and the innovations that they came up with for that first movie that Raimi has kept in his subsequent filmmaking is really, really interesting. Everything from with Bruce Campbell is in one of Raimi's movies, which you can count on Bruce Campbell being in a Sam Raimi movie.
Yeah, Bruce, all the Spider-Man movies.
Bruce Campbell will get covered in copious amounts of blood. And it was kind of a joke and a gag and a rib, if you will, that Raimi was playing on Bruce Campbell throughout the movie, because the blood in that first Evil Dead movie was made out of red food coloring and Cairo corn syrup. And so they would blast it. It was so cold in Tennessee, Bruce's shirt froze and was so hard from the corn syrup that it broke in pieces. And, you know, if you read about this, like, these were a bunch of college kids trying to make a film to try and make it. By the time that movie's done, it's like Sam, Bruce, and like two other people, like all the actors and stuff. Like, the reason actors died is because they were leaving the production. There are people who left the production that started in a role, and because they left the production, a different actor is under the makeup and the prosthetics. They talk about the contact lenses. It's a really interesting read, and something I strongly recommend if you are interested in making films. Read Bruce Campbell's first autobiography of Chinsky Kill. It's great, great book.
It's fascinating that they pulled all that train wreck together to deliver one of the most beloved horror movies of the 80s.
Like, them describing how they made the camera shot where the possession or the spirit is like traveling through the forest. It's amazing that they came up with it and how they did that. I love it. It's a terrific, terrific movie. And I can see it. It's the one that's serious. You know what I mean? Like, that's the scary one. Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness, right? They hedged more into camp. Now, I will say Evil Dead 2, if you want to see how good of an actor Bruce Campbell really was and is, the hand scene when his hand gets possessed and the work he does fighting his own hand before he cuts it off is amazing. Like, that sort of physical acting is a rarity. So I guess that leaves just my number one, right? And was it your number two?
It's
is that what it was?
Two. My number two.
So for me, it's Stanley Kubrick's The Shining. I want to say that by also articulating that I love the book. This is not the book, by any stretch of the imagination. And I think The Shining is one of the best books Stephen King ever wrote. And you want to talk about a book that builds tension masterfully, read The Shining, because it's intense and it's crazy. And you really feel for Jack Torrance in a way that I don't think you really do in The Shining.
Not in the movie. He's welcoming it in the movie to a large extent.
Right. Right. That's the thing, is Jack Nicholson and his portrayal of Jack Torrance is very much not about a man trying to get his life back together. It's, in my opinion, it's a man looking for a reason to let go. And I think that's a very important distinction. I think it's a fine distinction for the movie. I think that the surrealism, the use of color in The Shining is outstanding. The overall creep factor of the building. And that's the thing, is the hotel is the character that should really take charge here, and the way that it tortures Jack. And you just don't really see that as much in Jack Nicholson's portrayal, but Shelley Duvall, as
understated. I mean, wow.
As his wife, as Wendy, you know, the kid, Danny, all of it was just, it's so, again, it's creepy and it's unsettling and it's disturbing. And here's the thing, is whether you like Jack Nicholson's portrayal of Torrance or not, him chasing him through the hedge maze, screaming Danny, slowly and slowly getting more and more hoarse as he falls, you know, falls apart and eventually freezes to death and dies, it's ridiculous. It's horrifying what the building, like what the hotel drove him to and where it resulted and what we have here in this, you know, descent, rapid descent into insanity. Just so the twins, the old woman,
come play with us, Danny.
Yeah, the rotting old woman, like all of it. It's in the mood and the music, again, that music clearly had an influence on Spielberg.
Yeah.
As we saw in Ready Player One.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and that wasn't in the book at all. That whole scene was not in Ready Player One at all. They added that.
He made that up. Yep.
But I think you raise a good point. If you compare The Shining, the book, to the movie, you're going to run into problems with the two. Yes, they're based on the same fundamental foundational material. But if you're saying, okay, Jack Nicholson is not Jack Torrance from The Shining book, you're probably right about that. But if you just look at Jack Nicholson's portrayal of the Jack Torrance from the movie, it's a masterful portrayal. I mean, one of his best pieces of work ever. And he portrays this guy sliding into insanity at a rapid clip better than I think anybody could. And he's sitting there banging away at the typewriter for how many hours every day, writing the same line over and over and over and over again with different margins and different ways of presenting it.
Right.
You've got the hotel, which is crazy. You've got the, where he kind of like, you know, wanders into what is it, alternate reality, alternate dimension, or the hotel bringing all these other spirits and ghosts for that he can interact with him.
Yeah, well, and that's in the book. Like, that's the thing that's really interesting is that the book, like, has all, like, the hotel has this history of death and murder. And these spirits that are coming back are these old spirits that were involved in all these different deaths and murders. And that's what, you know, and that's what slowly drives, in the book, slowly drives him insane. Whereas in the movie, you gotta assume that some of it's the constraints of time. The book itself is way more about alcoholism, because that's like the big driving thing is that Jack is trying to get his life back together. He has a history of violence. He has a history of drinking. He broke Danny's arm. He's attacked Wendy. There's all these different things, and those get touched on in the movie, but it's just not the same. Right. Like you said, Dave, if you look at it through that lens of a different, like, if you just, you have to separate the book from the movie in that case. And if you want a true note for note of the book, Stephen King led a miniseries later on that he also altered slightly, and gave it a little bit of a happier sort of spin at the end. But it's basically a retelling. It was made in the 90s, but it was made for TV. Yeah. So it's a little less gripping.
That scene in the room, what is it? Room 237 or something? Like, I don't remember.
Right.
Where the girl comes out and they flip that so quick on you from being a semi-erotic experience for, I think, most of us at the time we were watching that were young men, or in your case, younger men. They flip that. They take it from a semi-erotic experience and make it fucking terrifying in a span of two seconds, 1 second. I mean,
it's intense.
It was done so well. Because I know this episode's running long, because of course we talk too much. Have you seen Dr. Sleep, the sequel?
I haven't seen the movie yet, but I've read the book.
Okay. I've heard various things. I've heard lots of people love it. Lots of people hate it, but
yeah, it's on the to-do list. I'm still, I still have Batman Hush to get through before I can move that one up a little bit. So
it's worth seeing.
See, you think I hate DC.
Even for a DC hater like you, it's worth watching, Patrick.
Fair enough. Because it's trash. Anyway, so that'll do it, everybody. This week's poll on Wednesday, or I'm sorry, on Tuesday, when the show hits, you'll get to pick between The Shining and Evil Dead.
That's going to be interesting. There are two very passionate fan bases about those two movies.
It is two very strong fan bases. We'll see how it goes. But as you mentioned, Dave, we've been running a little long on time. So we're going to head into the finale here. We're going to talk about next week. So next week, I thought, I think I want to save the cartoon idea for a different, just let us do our own top tens throughout. And that doesn't really fit with the 80s project, but I think we've covered five genres and there's a lot that we've left out. And so what I thought would be fun is for next week, and whether it's just the two of us or if we get somebody else in, the best of what's left. So I want you to pick 10 from the 80s of what's left. And it can be, I'd prefer it be movies that we haven't covered in any of these genres or any of this stuff that we've got there. I think that's still relatively easy to do.
There's a few.
Like my favorite movie of all time didn't fit into any of these genres. And so I will tell you right now, in my biased opinion, it will be one of the great movies of the 80s that I list.
Awesome.
And there may be a couple of comedies and some other things that, you know, didn't make mentions that I, you know, kind of walked back. I was like, I can't believe I forgot about this. I'll give you a taste. One of the movies out of sci-fi that I can't believe, I don't know that any of us talked about, Scanners.
Yeah, Scanners is one of those that they, you know, it's a sci-fi horror. But it's like, right. it wasn't, it's not a strong enough one to bump something out of sci-fi, and it's not strong enough to bump something out of horror, but combined.
I mean,
yeah,
blew a dude's head up.
Yeah.
Like, and talk about things that were unheard of at the time. So I think that'll be fun. Have a little bit of fun with that list. You know, and again, as always, these are our lists. So, you know, bend some rules, do what you need to do. I think it'll be a good result for us. I'm looking forward to talking about it. But that's going to do it for this week's edition of Bandwagon Nerds. Thank you for listening all the way through, everybody, letting Dave and I ramble a little bit more than usual. Didn't stay on track. Sorry, Greg. He was telling me at the trip, he was like, you guys got way more efficient with the list. And I was like, welp. So I'm sitting there doing this. I was like, well, we blew that one. So our bad. But Dave, why don't you tell everybody how they can find you on the social media and pimp any of your other podcasts? Let's do that.
Yeah, just check me out on Twitter at AttitudeAgg. That is at AttitudeAgg, or on Facebook.com/AttitudeOfAggression. And yeah, when you remove the bandwagon aspect of the Bandwagon Nerds, we just ramble for too long.
I guess so.
I guess.
Right. And you can follow me at Wrestling Realist on the Twitter. That is at WrestlingRealist. I am also on the Greg DeMarco Show, also part of the Chair Shot Radio Network. You can catch us on Wednesdays. Those always drop. Greg's been trying to drop them in the morning at around 6 a.m. And then finally, please follow us if you haven't already on Twitter at Bandwagon Nerds. No special spellings, just at Bandwagon Nerds. And that'll do it for us, Dave. Any last words for the group before I say goodbye?
No, sir. Thank you for coming back from Vegas. Yeah, there you go.
Oh, happy to do it. I wouldn't miss this for the world. That's going to do it for us. Have a good week, everybody. Crawl yourself out of the basement and get a little bit of sunshine. And we'll see you next week with the finale of the 80s Project on Bandwagon Nerds.